everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2025, and this is episode 431. And we are having a conversation today about the work of philosopher John Searle. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. R. Keith Lofton, who is Professor of Philosophy and Chair of the Department of Politics, Philosophy, and Economics at Dallas Baptist University. Keith has written an online article for the Christian Research Journal in our Philosopher's series. His article is called John Searle, Unwitting Ally of the Soul, and you can read it for free at equip.org. That's equip.org. Keith, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Hey, my pleasure, Melanie. Always great to chat with you.
Well, today we are talking about a new article that Keith has written for our ongoing Philosopher's series that we've had ongoing for quite some time, probably more than 10 years now. And this particular article focuses on the work of Dr. John Searle, and we had kind of alluded to some of his work in a previous article that Keith wrote for us last year. But as I said, it's in our philosopher series, but there might be a lot of readers or listeners who've never heard of John Searle. So who is he and why has his work been so noted?
Yeah, thanks, Melanie. Right. Yeah, I think most philosophers are not exactly household names in our society, unfortunately. John Searle is very well known among professional philosophers. He was a professor for many years. He taught for some 60 years at the University of California, Berkeley. But I think Searle is largely unknown to most of our listeners, unless they've done really advanced study in specifically the philosophy of mind, which is Searle's main area of specialization. Other philosophers are more well known, I think, to our listeners in virtue of having written broadside attacks on the faith or Christian beliefs that would sort of put them on Christians' radar. But John Searle has not, to my knowledge, written anything along those lines. And so I think is largely well known. Searle is born 1932 and, as I say, taught philosophy for six decades at UC Berkeley. There was for a time there at UC Berkeley, the John Searle Center for Social Ontology. But about 5 or 6 years ago, Searle's career at UC Berkeley ended under a cloud in the wake of accusations of misconduct and relating to students and workers. And I think for that reason, the center at Berkeley was discontinued. But during his career, Searle published many scholarly books, I think over a dozen. And dozens of articles in professional academic journals. He had done his undergrad and graduate degrees in philosophy at the University of Oxford, very prestigious. He received a handful of honorary doctorates from universities around the world. He, in 2004, was a recipient of the National Humanities Medal, awarded by the National Endowment for Humanities, among other honors. His work is focused on two main areas of specialty, the philosophy of language, but also, and more especially, I think, the philosophy of mind. And it's his work on the philosophy of mind and consciousness that I think are of particular interest to a Christian audience interested in philosophy.
So, as I mentioned a moment ago, that you wrote an article for us last year about consciousness and AI in particular, as well as the Christian doctrine of Imago Dei. And in that article, you mentioned Dr. Searle's Chinese Room argument, but you don't refer to that in this particular article. So can you briefly summarize what that argument is?
Right. Yeah, I really enjoyed writing that article for you guys, Consciousness, AI, and the Imago Dei. I think I find his argument, the Chinese Room argument, so interesting and clever, but also compelling. In brief, Searle's Chinese Room argument is an argument that attempts to prove that artificial intelligence, despite its very impressive capabilities, nevertheless cannot reproduce, or as people would say, cannot have consciousness. And sort of set the stage to grasp how AI works. Think, Searle would have us think in terms of three basic steps. There's input that goes into, secondly, the relevant programming algorithm, plus, if you like, enormous data, which we know, especially generative AI, just these large language models, has massive data. And then thirdly, there is the output. So it's input, programming plus data, then output. So when fed input, AI produces output that may well be indistinguishable from the output of human consciousness. This is the bane of many teachers trying to grade essays. Was it produced by my student or AI? Now, many people think that AI's ability to produce output indistinguishable from the output of human consciousness, and that's what's colloquially known as passing the Turing test. Many people think that means AI must have understanding, which is to say consciousness. But Searle argues, and I find it persuasive, that the input programming output model just cannot establish understanding. So no matter how sophisticated the programming may be, simply functioning in a certain way just isn't identical to understanding. AI can manipulate and mimic syntax. In fact, it can do it a lot faster than I can. I can't write an essay in 10 minutes. But despite that, it must be remembered that syntax alone has literally no meaning. In order to understand the sort of the distinctive feature of genuine consciousness, something must be able to think about the meaning of the symbols. And this is what Searle calls semantic understanding. And that is not accomplishable merely through complicated syntactical operations. And he's got a great thought experiment called the Chinese Room that he uses to convey the premises of that argument I've just given a thumbnail sketch for. But I just invite readers to check out the previous article. I think it's just a quick link embedded in this article, and so readers can, I think, find it pretty easy.
So one thing that we've talked a lot about on this podcast is, you know, worldview, and all of us have a worldview on everything. I think that we might not think that we do, but we do, whether even as Christians it's informed by biblical truth or not, you know. And so people having worldviews includes philosophers like Searle, scientists, historians. And speaking about AI and historians, I'm in the midst of reading a new book by Yuval Noah Harari called Nexus. And for sure, his worldview as a historian is quite evident and quite biased against all religion, particularly Christianity. And actually, that book is about AI, so it's kind of fascinating as to some of his theses in there. But so, you know, we have our worldview, and it informs our presuppositions, our thoughts, and in the case of philosophers, their writings and their work. So can you kind of summarize for us what John Searle's worldview is?
Yeah, I think you're right about the impactful role that a person's worldview has in informing the beliefs they'll take seriously, the theories they'll consider to be live options. The Nexus volume does sound interesting. So Searle is, to be sure, a thoroughgoing scientific naturalist. Readers of your journal will probably be familiar with naturalism, generic naturalism. A scientific naturalism, in brief, is a worldview that basically says that the universe, which is a catch-all term to refer to everything that exists, is entirely accessible to the natural sciences. So there's nothing in existence which can't be got to by the natural sciences. The only real, or maybe the very best kind of knowledge in our universe is scientific knowledge. I think, you know, readers need not look terribly far to find evidence that that's a pretty dominant view in our society today. So according to scientific naturalism, like Searle's, everything, the history of the universe, the apparent fine-tuning, the nature of morality, the nature of consciousness, all of these things will be explained at some point, or at the very least justified by science. So science is sort of the gold standard when it comes to knowledge. There can be no appeal to God or angelic activity or just non-physical stuff, what philosophers call substance, in explaining the nature of reality. And so for Searle, this commitment to scientific naturalism factors pretty prominently in the way that he understands the human person. And here we're going to really be focusing in on the human person as a conscious agent. We have the ability to perceive the world and engage in rational behavior in the way that, say, my dog Winston cannot. And he's fascinated by that, but through the lens of scientific naturalism. So as he says at one point in his work, he says, ultimate reality, to speak rather grandly, is the reality described by chemistry and physics. So it's not exactly a heartwarming. I doubt that the, you know, the Hallmark movie channel is going to make a movie based off of that line. But Searle would say that's just the hard and fast reality, that ultimately it's all chemistry and physics.
Well, there's a lot to look forward to this year on the Postmodern Realities podcast. We have a lot of interesting topics that are coming your way in 2025, including towards the end of the year, our annual focus on the cults and the occult that will be in October. So these are all kinds of things that you don't want to miss out. And as you know, we have a brand new article along with the author of that article in a podcast for you every single week and free article on our website. So what is coming up? We actually have an article coming up on atheism and happiness. And we look at the documentary film, Am I a Racist? We have an article coming up on the work of Peter Enns, one of the evolving Christians who now does not hold to Christian orthodoxy. We've got something coming up in our literary apologetics called The Poetry of George Herbert and Why It's Important to the Christian Apologist. We also take a look at trauma and therapy in Christianity later this spring. So there are so many interesting topics coming up, including, of course, the big blockbuster tentpole movies that are coming out this summer. And we have another one coming out in the Jurassic Park series, of course, DC Superman Legacy, and we won't want to miss Marvel. We haven't covered Marvel in years, and the Fantastic Four is coming out, as well as more literary apologetics and all kinds of other helpful things for you, both culturally and just classical apologetics. We want to take a look at what's happening with Gen Z. Lisa Cooper, who's been a regular writer for us, has done some research on Gen Z and their religious belief, and particularly young women who are leaving the church at a higher rate than young men and deconverting. What is going on with that? You won't want to miss out on our take about Severance Season 2. It's finally here, so we're going to cover that as well. So you'll want to stay tuned, and we would like your help. Please do all the things: rate, review, and tell people about this podcast. Whether you share something on your social media account or simply tell a friend or text a link to a friend, just get the word out about the Postmodern Realities podcast, because we are here to equip you and to equip the Christian church to know what they believe and why they believe it and how they can use various different topics as springboards to be able to share the gospel. Well, thank you for all of your support for the work of the Christian Research Journal and our podcast. And now, back to my conversation in our philosopher series with Keith Lofton and philosopher John Searle. We were just talking about John Searle's worldview that is rooted in scientific naturalism. So based on that, I would assume that he is not a fan of religion. Did he write anything about religion in specific? I mean, I think about this, even if you hold to that, it's either some people are really anti-religion, like Yuval Harari, or you aren't, or you ignore it. But how does he look at religion?
Yeah, you're right. He's not a big fan of religion, but I will say that he isn't, there have been some naturalists, think of like, Richard Dawkins is just got a long track record of saying some pretty nasty things about religion and those who practice it. But John Searle isn't just looking for a microphone every time he turns around to attack religion. But nevertheless, he does allude to religion from time to time. I'm not familiar with any, you know, sort of article or book length attack on theism or anything like that. But he has written, for example, in his very famous book, Mind, Language, and Society, he's sort of dismissive. He says, nowadays, nobody bothers. He's talking about to attack theistic belief. Nobody bothers. And it's considered in slightly bad taste to even raise the question of God's existence. He goes on to say that matters of religion are like matters of sexual preference. They're not to be discussed in public. And even the abstract questions are discussed only by bores. He's elsewhere takes sort of a snooty, I think a little bit of an arrogant stance. He talks in terms of the educated people of society know better than to bother, you know, this childish considerations like religious believers do. But what I find interesting, if I could just continue on this, although he's pretty condescending, nevertheless, fellow naturalist, atheist, who we know that Searle respects, he quotes, for example, Thomas Nagel, a contemporary who also wrote in the same areas that Searle did. Thomas Nagel says, quote, I want atheism to be true and am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. In the article, I quote also Quint Smith, who's now passed away, but Quint Smith's incredibly well-respected philosopher, and he talks about not the slow disappearance of religious belief, but instead its prominence and growth in, of all places, philosophy departments since the 1960s. And so I'm not sure, you know, Searle, maybe because of his dismissive stance, hasn't really kept up with work in the philosophy of religion and in metaphysics, but I think that he is conspicuously out of step with the perception among other atheists of the legitimacy of religious belief.
So in your article, you talk about Searle's philosophy of mind, which is, you know, his view of consciousness, human consciousness in particular. So why is that your focus in the article? And what he says about human consciousness, do you think he would apply that to any consciousness, even, you know, the consciousness of a whale?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first part, I think that there's particular interest here for at least two reasons. First, it's timely. I mean, you can't go anywhere without hearing conversation about artificial intelligence and overwhelmingly generative AI, because that's been so widely appealing to many in the general public. And for the first part, I think Searle's arguments, not just the Chinese Room argument, but inclusive of that, but his arguments regarding the nature of consciousness generally, I think are relevant because AI has sort of invited the philosophy of mind into the limelight. So as once, it's timely. Secondly, I think that Searle's work on consciousness is so interesting because Searle is almost alone in occupying a sort of a strange and it seems to me uncomfortable middle ground between general naturalist on the one hand. He identifies as part of that camp, but definitely has pitched his tent well on the outskirts of the naturalist camp on when it comes to consciousness. And on the other hand, he is in that sort of odd no man's land between the naturalist and dualist, where Christians are long encamped in the dualist area. We believe that the human being comprises in some way a physical body and distinctly a non-physical substance, our mind, our soul. Searle doesn't want to enter the dualist camp, but he is conspicuously out of step with his fellow naturalists who would reduce consciousness to exactly the material. And Searle, as I say, really isn't comfortable with that. And so it makes him really interesting as a thinker. Oh, and the other part, I think I'm not aware that he's talked about consciousness in non-human life. I don't want to put words in his mouth. I think Christians can be comfortable talking about consciousness, say of a whale or again of my dog Winston, but it is not identical to human consciousness. I think we should think of a gradated spectrum, a scale of consciousness where capacity increases as you slide up the scale to human personal souls.
This is not a conversation for this podcast, but it's interesting that evolution can't really explain consciousness, not even consciousness of a dog or a whale. And then also, and it completely, also not for this conversation, but it's fascinating to me that one of Harari's theses is that, yes, AI will never be conscious. It can't be conscious, but it can be very dangerous because it can mimic certain things that can cause human agents to act in a very bad way.
Right. I think that's right.
So that was kind of fascinating. It can actually make decisions based on the inputs that it has, not because it's conscious, but because it's been had all these various different inputs, and it then could mimic human decisions and other things which could affect humans. But that's a different conversation. He has a fascinating thesis nonetheless. But you know that he's an atheist. He believes in scientific naturalism, and so you know it seems that most atheists do hold to scientific naturalism. That's just kind of common. But what is it in particular about John Searle's view of the mind that, as you just kind of alluded to, it sets him apart from everybody else? And how unique is that? Do you think there is some room at some point for him to consider other views, perhaps because he's got this little bit of a different view? He's not as hardcore as, I guess we would say, as other atheist philosophers.
Yeah, I think that's on the right track. His scientific naturalism is the backdrop for what he writes. And as you say, most naturalists are adherents of some form of naturalism. And I think scientific naturalism tends to predominate. I think I'll just make a quick note. There's a terrific book out in the last year by Brandon Rickabaugh and J.P. Moreland on the philosophy of mind. It's a book that argues quite extensively for substance dualism, the typically Christian view. And they note that substance dualism has not been tried and found wanting so much as it has been judged unacceptable and left untried by scientific naturalists because of their worldviews, tendency to rule it out as a serious option. But Searle is no friend of substance dualism, but he has written some pretty harsh things about the general works on the nature of consciousness and the mind by his fellow naturalists. He writes, for example, in his book, A Mind, A Brief Introduction, he says, there's a sense in which materialism is the religion of our time, at least among most of the professional experts in the fields of philosophy, psychology, cognitive science, and other disciplines that study the mind. But he says, like more traditional religions, materialism is accepted without question, and it, materialism, provides the framework within which other questions can be posed, addressed, and answered. Now, he's not writing this in a praiseworthy manner. He is observing the way that work in the philosophy of mind has been dominated by this materialism. And so elsewhere, he writes in his book, The Rediscovery of Mind, listen to how harsh this is. From the perspective of the last 50 years, quote, the field of philosophy of mind presents a very curious spectacle. The most striking feature is how much mainstream philosophy of mind of the past 50 years seems obviously false. He says, I believe there is no other area of contemporary analytic philosophy where so much is said that is so implausible. Obvious facts about the mental, such as that we all really do have subjective conscious mental states, and that these are not eliminable in favor of anything else, is just denied by most of his contemporaries. And that's true. On scientific naturalism, on materialist-dominated philosophy of mind, the nature of consciousness, both its functions and properties, tend to be reduced to the material. So the mental is reduced to the material. That means it is explained as being something material. For example, it's the mirror. It's identical with, for example, the firing of a neuron, say, or a certain sequence of electrochemical events in one's brain. And that tends to eliminate genuine consciousness, as Searle says. And our side, the substance dualist, are, you know, of course, cheering this on. We totally agree. But yet Searle is not willing to embrace substance dualism. He does want to be a kind of a materialist, but nevertheless hold on to these non-reducible features of our mental life. And so that puts him in really an interesting place, I think.
Well, at the beginning of your article about Searle, you quote Augustine, and this is the quote that you put there, quote, "We could also define man like this and say, man is a rational substance consisting of soul and body. In this case, there is no doubt that man has a soul, which is not a body, and a body, which is not a soul," end quote. So is Augustine saying there's a definite distinction in humans between our body and our minds? And is that how you would define dualism?
Yeah, I love that quote. It comes from his phenomenal work, De Trinitate, on the Trinity. Yes, I think he's absolutely right about this. I think that human beings are entities that are comprised of two different substances, hence the word dualism, substance dualism. Substance is a funny word in philosophy. Just sort of think of it as like it just means stuff. We are, in short, physical bodies and a distinct soul, a non-physical soul. This, as Paul puts it in his letter to the Corinthians, we humans are come apartable. We aren't meant to be separated from our bodies, but we can be. This explains the continuity of identity. This explains the nature of consciousness and so forth. It's connected, as I wrote in the previous article, to our being created in God's image. It's not that our bodies are worthless or nasty things anchoring us to the physical reality here below. That's Gnosticism. That's, I think, a heresy. But it is nevertheless true that it's metaphysically possible for us to be separated from our bodies. Hence, many of the things Paul says about, you know, for example, being absent from the body but present with the Lord, for example, are coherent. So this is undesirable. It's not good. He refers to it as a state of nakedness when we are apart from our bodies. It's not desirable, but it is nevertheless metaphysically possible. And that goes to the core of answering the question substantially, what is a human? So yes, I am in agreement with the quote from Augustine there, but John Searle is most emphatically not in agreement with it. There are some Christians who would not be comfortable with what Searle has said. These are the so-called Christian physicalists. They can read about them online. I edited a book a few years ago with a colleague, Joshua Ferris, called Christian Physicalism? Because we are not convinced that the belief that Augustine is wrong and that physicalism is true, we're not convinced that that's compatible with many Christian doctrines. And so we spend that book going doctrine by doctrine, trying to demonstrate the incompatibility of that view.
So, you know, you've mentioned in this podcast that John Searle is, you know, not really in step with the majority of naturalists because of his belief in non-material conscious states. But you also said that he believes that everything that exists is material. So if he believes in a non-material conscious state, then does that really mean he would agree with Augustine that he's really a dualist?
It's a great question. It's a question that I can't shake myself when it comes to his thoughts. So let me back up and get a running start to this, because I think this is a really key point for readers to pick up on. And so I said a moment ago that Searle insists that we have what he calls genuine conscious states. He means things that we're all familiar with in our ordinary experience. So let's take an example, something we're all unfortunately pretty familiar with, and that is the mental state of pain, being in pain. So for example, I can still remember when I was a kid, we had a Dodge Caravan, as I'm sure many families did back in the 90s. And once that side sliding door, I was in the front passenger seat and I was mindlessly just had my hand above the seat and was just holding on to something, just not really focused on what I was holding on to until the sliding door was slid shut. And it became quickly and very painfully clear that my forefinger on my right hand was up in the track where the sliding thing slammed shut. And oh my goodness, it hurt so bad. And I experienced the sensation of being in pain so vividly, I can still remember it. Well, dualists and naturalists agree that these events happen. We have the event of being in pain. But here's the tricky thing. Neither the neurophysiological event on one hand, nor the attendant brain states. So yes, when my finger gets slammed in the door, bells and whistles light up and fire in my physical brain. But none of those events, none of these brain events are identical to my being in pain. Well, why is that? They attend my being in pain, but they aren't identical. That's because being in pain is an intrinsically first-person sensation. In other words, your pain just is a subjective feeling. So you could have the experience of getting your finger slammed in the door as identically as we can make it to my experience, but your being in pain is not identical in any way to my being in pain. They're subjective. So by describing a sensation or some kind of a mental state as being a what philosophers call first person or like private state, we mean to say that the subject who's having the sensation, in this case me, the haver of the pain, I enjoy kind of a privileged access. You can have like the most amazing brain scan machine available hooked up to me as my finger is slammed in the door. You can see all of the attendant brain events happening, but you're not thereby seeing my pain itself. This is because it's not possible for a public description, what philosophers call a third person description, to fully capture my being in pain. And for Searle, this is fundamental and true, and presents a demand, uncomfortable as it may be, to revisit naturalist views of the flashy of mind and figure out how to explain these genuinely conscious experiences. He says we can just reduce them the way most naturalists have, but by doing that, we have written out of existence the genuineness of pain. And so he thinks that is a blocked route. We cannot take seriously that route. These subjective experiences, he calls them, are sine qua non to what consciousness requires. Okay, and so from there, he has insisted that genuine first-person mental states exist and that these can't be reduced to material realities. Okay, this opens the door to what philosophers call not substance dualism, as we talked about a moment ago, but what's called property dualism. Okay, so just a quick aside here. What's a property? A property is a feature of something. So my computer that I'm looking at right now has the property of weighing 4.5 pounds. It has the property of being gray. These are physical properties. But there are also non-physical properties. So I'm currently thinking about my computer, so my current thought has a non-physical property of being about the physical features of my laptop. And those non-physical properties cannot be reduced to physical properties. This is called property dualism. They're two fundamentally different, non-conflatable kinds of properties. So when Searle insists that our genuinely conscious experiences can't be reduced to the physical, he is leaving the door open. In fact, it seems like he entails the real existence of non-physical properties. And this is where things get a little interesting for Searle, because he is dogmatically insistent that he does not believe in property dualism. He has made up a name for his view, biological naturalism. But it does seem to me that he cannot get around this reality that he has very successfully carved out and defended space for non-physical properties, which does seem to be uncomfortable in its situatedness against his scientific naturalist worldview. And this is what makes him, as I titled the article, kind of an unwitting or unintentional ally of substance dualism. He is defending one of the basic beliefs of a substance dualist without any intention whatever of helping substance dualists at all.
So, you know, I just want to ask you, because I'm sure some people are going to think this conversation was a little bit heady. They have to think about what we were saying. You know, why should Christians care about his work? Why should Christians care about the philosophy of mind? It just sounds like some esoteric field of study, you know, by academics that has no bearing on their everyday life.
Well, I am just shocked anyone would think that. No, having taught philosophy now for many years at the university, I am familiar with the glazed eye look. It's not always easy to see the relevance of the subtler parts of philosophy, and philosophy of mind certainly tends to dwell there. I remember coming home from college and grad school to, you know, see my family over Thanksgiving break, and you know, there's the inevitable, well, what are you working on? And you explain something like this, and you can just see the oh my gosh, I'm so sorry I asked look on otherwise loving faces. Yeah, I think this really does matter in a few ways that I hope that Christians will consider taking seriously, even if they realize it would take some work to get through it. First of all, it goes fundamentally straight to the question of what am I? What sort of a critter am I? And that is relevant to Christians because whatever you are, you are a human being created by God for reasons. You have the parts of you that you have because God saw fit and indeed declared good that you have them. This goes to, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the question of if I am what I am in virtue of God's good creative activity, and I am created in the image of God, then what does that mean? I mean, the history of Christianity is just filled, as we mentioned with the Augustine article, quote before, it's filled with Christians taking very seriously the question, what is a human being? Both because we ought to want to know, because God did it and declared it good, but also we're going to have a tough time getting our heads around, what am I for? What am I to do on earth if we don't first know what we are? And so this is, I think, both intrinsically important and instrumentally important in keeping with figuring out the next steps of what is my vocation? What am I capable of? Plus, it's just really interesting once you get into it.
I do think it's important for Christians to know this because of the fact that we are Christians and we believe the Bible is authoritative and true, and that, you know, we were created to have a relationship with God. And if that is true, what does it mean for people who don't believe that they have a soul, that they're just, you know, a meat suit, so to speak? So I just think this is very important, and this should motivate us to think about evangelism and, you know, just other things that are very important for the Christian life, and to let people know who God is and why they were created and why they exist.
Right. Right. I think that's right. If we are created and that this is in part, this is, let me say, a feature of being created in the image of God, our being rational and having conscious states, then I think that being in intellectual neutral or just sort of taking a dismissive stance toward thinking hard about reality, Christians really ought to have pause. Because if we're created to be rational, then it may be that the option has not been left open to us to just be intellectually lazy. It may be that God is glorified and honored by our just thinking really hard about things that matter. I think this is not too far off of what is included in Romans 12:1.
And I also think as we have conversations as Christian apologists with other people, specifically if they hold to scientific naturalism, it does matter because right now in our culture, everyone cares about identity. Really, they do. Who are they? What defines them? What does it mean to be human? I think that's bigger now than it has been perhaps in the past, just in terms of popular culture and our society, at least in the West. So I do think these are things that we need to grapple with and think about, especially in light of Christian apologetics. Well, on a much lighter note, I have a fun question for Keith.
All right.
The year has just started. So as you think, when you come to December at the end of this year, what is a word that you hope would have been true and describe your year in 2025?
That's a good question. I think there's the word that comes to mind, as Paul writes in Colossians, it's just excellence. As a father, as a husband, as a scholar and a teacher, I as short as I fall of this goal, I think year after year, I really just want to strive for really genuine excellence in each thing that I undertake, which is so hard. Certainly, I'm not able to do that on my own. I need and depend on the Lord for each step I manage in the direction of excellence. I need the support of the Christian community, great colleagues who are like-minded here at DBU to help me, a family that supports. But I really do want to strive to be excellent in 2025.
Well, that is a very good word. So thank you, Keith, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You've been listening to episode 431 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. And today's guest was Dr. Keith Lofton. He has written an article for the Christian Research Journal for our ongoing Philosophers series. His article is called John Searle, Unwitting Ally of the Soul. And you can read it for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.